Welcome back to Decouple. Today I'm joined by Dave March. Dave is a podcast fan and listener who reached out to me to do an event recently on a LinkedIn Live seminar. And this is one of the joys of podcasting is the folks that reach out to you. And this wasn't a pitch to me anyway, but after meeting Dave and having a pre-chat before the LinkedIn Live event, I found him to be a pretty fascinating guy. So Dave, you know, I've just met you. I know a few things about you. You're wearing your Exergy Energy yep. shirt. I want you to explain that. And you also ran, I believe, a solar business called Entropy Energy, yep. Which seemed to me when I heard about it to be very, very fitting. So why don't you just take a moment and fill in the audience on who exactly you are and what it is.
Sure, that Chris. And thank you for, the honor of appearing on Decouple, one of my favorite podcasts, by the way. And I, recommend it to lots of people and for all the great work that you do with Canadians for nuclear energy. So huge proponent of your work. So me, I'm an engineer by training, graduate in quantitative finance degree. Have been basically an entrepreneur, started three companies. And before that, chief operating officer with a lot of experience in operations, manufacturing and things like that. So Exergy Energy is a concierge utility for organizations where energy is mission critical. Now, I use the term utility there with great poetic license, right? We're not like a true registered utility, but it's more illustrative to our customers who think of anything that's coming out of the wires or the pipe for natural gas as coming from the utility. So we're a concierge utility in that we stand between the customer and I'll say the complex energy markets to help them get the energy they need, whether it's natural gas or electricity, but get it in the form that they want with reliability, power quality, green, renewable, whatever it is that they need to meet their corporate objectives. That's what Exergy does. Now, the reality in essentially the genesis of Exergy is we want to help our customers manage and, if possible, prosper through the energy transition. The energy transition is going to be a bumpy road. Lots of issues, I'm sure that we'll discuss somewhat later today as well. But the whole concept of how energy interacts with business has changed, and it's going to get more complicated all the time. So we have stepped in to help businesses be able to focus on what they do best, which is whatever their business is, let the experts handle the energy. From your question on entropy and Exergy, I'm a chemical engineer, so apologies for I couldn't get past E's in the alphabet there. Exergy means the maximum amount of work that you can obtain from the energy available in a system. So we thought it was sort of illustrative of what we're trying to do for our customers, which is to make them as productive as possible with the energy markets as they are. We started Exergy Energy in 2019. In 2013, I started a company called Entropy. And Entropy was a developer, constructor, and manager of utility scale renewables. So primarily solar projects, but we did do some other, anaerobic digestion and things like that. We built 450 megawatts of utility scale solar, invested about $700 million. And what happened was we really learned the energy markets there, but more importantly, we learned that businesses are not being well served by utilities and the energy markets, and it's only getting worse and more complex all the time. So we started Exergy as a follow-on to Entropy to focus exclusively on helping customers manage the energy situation.
No, and that's what sort of tweaked my interest, definitely. I mean, I practice in a mission critical, as you put it, environment where moment-to-moment energy means dialysis machines running, ventilators running or not, all sorts of, very vulnerable patients hooked up to machines which need ultra-reliable energy. And, I've become quite cynical, I think, as I dive deeper into understanding energy and energy markets, et cetera. But you know, the whole idea of an energy transition, I always kind of do air quotes around it, because of course we're adding some renewables and you know, low carbon energy to a system that's continually expanding. But leaving that aside, so many threads I want to tug on. But before I do, actually, I'm actually just wanting to dive a tiny bit deeper into XRG. Some of my listeners are going to be bored by this, but basically, just to clarify, what you're saying is XRG refers to the work that's done. So it leaves out the waste heat, essentially, if we're talking about like thermal generation. Is that what it means?
So again, XRG being the maximum amount of work you can get out of the energy in a system. Whether or not we can use the waste heat or not is dependent upon the customer's, you know, operation. If there's no right. use for waste heat, then the maximum amount of work we can get out doesn't include waste heat, if that, you know, makes sense.
Right? And if there is a use for waste heat, then you're getting more total XRG out, yeah. or more potential of the work out. And you're never
also it's just a name. Okay.
Yeah, got you.
The value of the company is really in helping them manage, again, this energy transition, which is going to be, and I hate to say it, it is going to be painful for companies.
Yeah.
And what I like to do, if I have a second, is sort of go back. You can see I got lots of gray hair. My children are grown up and have their own kids. I know you just had a child, I think, isn't that right?
Five years ago.
Okay, I'm a lot older than you. When I was an operations guy running manufacturing plants and things like that, in the United States, energy is inexpensive, except when it isn't there. Okay, then it's like the price elasticity of energy is almost infinite. If it's not there, it's a big problem. In your case, people die and things like that. For businesses, it shuts things down. But from a cultural perspective, I didn't worry about energy when I was running manufacturing plants and things like that. It was inexpensive, and I'm going to go back to it's still inexpensive, but it was inexpensive, and it was pretty bloody reliable, and the power quality was good. In the United States today, for most manufacturing companies, energy only constitutes about 4% of their cost of goods sold. So people are talking about, oh, energy wow. costs and everything else. It really isn't that big a driver. But what it is it's absolutely essential, right? So if you don't have it, you'll pay anything you can get for it. But when you have it, it really isn't that expensive. So businesses didn't think about energy that much. You know, you had your local utility, you went to your utility, you say, I need an energy, you know, contract, you got it. This is what it's going to cost. Now, with the energy transition, that is changing, and energy is becoming much more complicated. So again, looking at it from a business management perspective, business managers want sort of security and surety. So I need to budget, I need to make my quarterly numbers and all that kind of stuff. Before, I had an energy contract. I was going to pay whatever it was, 8 cents kilowatt hour, blah, 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 blah. I didn't worry about it. Now, the energy markets have gotten highly volatile and they're getting worse. Yeah. So now your energy procurement, your strategy becomes super important. And then at the same time, we've got power quality issues coming in. We'll talk more about that. And just resiliency and reliability. The number of outages has gone up an order of magnitude, you know, in the last 10 years. That's very significant. The power quality problems have increased 14-fold in the last 5 years. So energy, which used to be something that me as a, you know, as an operations guy could ignore, is no longer the case.
Just really quickly, you said power quality. Just wanted to get a sense of, you know, define that term. And also, I'm curious about what we define as an outage. There was a fabulous documentary out of Germany, of all places, produced by state media, Deutsche Welle. It was looking at the energy transition and like limits to it and whether it was faltering. And a big part of the analysis was sort of the risk of catastrophic blackouts. But in some of the reporting, they went to what I recall was it's a company that creates some of the electromagnets and copper wiring for wind turbines. And this company was complaining that, you know, a blackout, what is officially registered as a blackout is, you know, a minute or two. And when they have grid disruptions of microseconds, it completely screws up their industrial process. And they got to shuttle their machines down, and it's at least a six-figure expense to recalibrate and get back online. So I imagine, you know, doing what you do and, you know, these mission critical industries and these increasing concerns about reliability, I think a lot about vital signs as a medical doctor, but you've got your finger on the pulse of this. You're feeling some funky stuff happening. What's power quality and define outage for me?
Into sort of the two things. And a lot of it where it gets confusing is what the rules are for reporting an outage. So typically there is an industry standard report in the United States on outages. And in general, it does not include outages that are less than 5 minutes, right? So when I talk about outages increasing dramatically, those are ones that are longer typically than 5 minutes.
Wow. Then you have, wow. What about the sub 5 minutes?
Yeah. So that's a whole different, you know, situation. Most of those occur less than 30 seconds. The vast, vast majority occur less than 30 seconds. Many only just a couple of seconds. Now, you mentioned microseconds. In general, that would be too short to really cause disruptions. But what is happening, we have two things going on. One, our manufacturing processes are getting more sophisticated, more automated, and more complex than they used to be. And then number two, we have power quality declining. Now, what do I mean by power quality declining? So the power is coming in, I might have a voltage drop. So literally, the voltage is falling out. I could have a frequency issue. In business, we use three-phase power. One of the phases may drop out. One of the phases may become unsynchronized with the other phases, or they're not sufficiently balanced that way. Or I'll get transients, you know, blips that come through, fallouts that come through that may only be milliseconds in length. And then the other thing you get in is just noise. Noise being harmonics that are created and things like that. All of these can be enough for the control systems, the automation and control systems in a factory to literally shut down. So the
to scram.
Yeah, the outage may only be 2 to 3 seconds or maybe less than that. But reality is it'll bring you down for hours because everything has to be reset. All the machines. So let's think we've got injection molding machines or something like that. I've got plastic going in. All of a sudden, you know, we get a trip. The power doesn't, you know, it blinks for a couple of seconds or something, but the machine shut down. Now the machines have to be brought up, but the liquid plastic that's in that injection molding machine is now solidified or gotten really sticky. I got to tear it all down, clean it all up, rebuffer it, all that kind of stuff, and bring it back up. So it's not uncommon for, you know, complex organization, you know, a complex manufacturing, a blip of a few milliseconds to a second will take them down for an average of 5 to 7 hours. And these are not recorded by the utility. Power quality usually isn't recorded by the utility. And again, going back historically, when you had a power quality problem, and you called the utility, they pointed to you and said, it's probably your stuff, right? Now it is primarily the utility side of it is where these problems are coming in. It'll take you down. It'll be, you know, really nasty. Now, what's causing that? Well, it's a variety of things. One, intermittent renewables cause some very interesting thing. We're called the switching supplies in that create a lot of noise and harmonics. And when you have enough of them occurring, you know, around the place, you can get these issues, you know, created. So, you know, you sitting at your house and your neighbor has their solar on their rooftop exporting to the grid or something, your power quality could be inversely, you know, could be, you know, affected by that. Same as I've got, you know, an industrial site or something. Some of the buildings there have rooftop solar, et cetera, et cetera. They can cause noise on the lines that this, you know, that will literally bring you down. The way we find it, which is really interesting, is we provide backup as a service, power quality as a service. There's no upfront cost to our customers. We just have a long-term agreement where we sort of manage their energy, you know, over 10 years, quality, reliability, and everything else. They'll contact us and they'll say, we need a backup generator. We'll go, why do you need a backup generator? Oh, we're going down once a month or something and we're down for 7 hours. So, you know, we're pretty good at this, right? So we'll go and we'll look at the utility reports and things and go, there's no record of any outages. Oh, yeah. It's just this little blip. Well, unfortunately, a backup generator isn't going to do anything for you there. Because under the best circumstances, a backup generator will take 6 to 10 seconds to start. Best circumstances, those are fast start, what are called in your world, life safety backups, right? Yeah, if I'm getting taken down, you know, by something that's 3 seconds or less, that generator is not going to do anything for you. So we are now incorporating a lot more uninterruptible power supplies and, you know, what's called ride through for systems. And essentially the way you can think about it is it's like a big battery. I hate to use the battery term, but it's like a big battery. And what we're doing is we're taking the incoming power, converting it to DC, going into the battery, converting it back to AC, and then feeding your plant. So if there's any hiccup out of here, the battery is riding through. And typically for our installations, we'll have that ride through, meaning the UPS can hold the facility for 3 to 5 minutes. So one, if there's a hiccup, nobody sees it. If there's an outage, we know there's an outage, but you don't want to start generators for a 3 second outage or a 5 second outage or something, or even a minute outage. You kind of want to look at it and say, is it really out? Then start your generators and we will switch over. So that's what we're seeing a lot in the industry. And we expect it just to get worse as you get more and more intermittent renewables. And one of the things to recognize, you have a solar farm, we built lots of solar farms. You got clouds coming over, solar output can drop by 60% in a matter of a few seconds, depending on the size of the farm and things like that. So that's going to cause interesting glitches and blips and things on the line. Now, if it's tied into the transmission line and it's miles from you, not a big deal. There's a lot of, you know, basic spinning inertia in it. But if it's close to you, so that the impedance factor between where that's happening and your load is relatively short, you may have power quality problems. And again, we're seeing it all the time these days.
It's interesting. A friend of mine was in Germany recently visiting with some pro-nuclear advocates. And one of them has become very wealthy selling diesel generators. And he sort of foresaw this. I don't think he took over like a monopoly of the diesel generator backup business, but he foresaw the grid instability. I think he's an electrical engineer and got in early. You know, this, you're describing the fragilization of the grid. I've also called it the Nigerification of the grid, which is probably a little bit hyperbolic. But, you know, what this all sounds like it amounts to is we used to have a very reliable power system. You could trust it. We all paid into it. You know, whether that was state owned or, you know, TVA or a big utility, vertically integrated utility, they're responsible for delivering reliable energy. That's kind of disappeared with energy only markets. And now, you know, in terms of explaining the Nigerification, I mean, there's so much grid defection in Nigeria. There's a diesel backup system, which costs billions of dollars more than their entire grid infrastructure. It's used, you know, probably actually pretty frequently, but I do, you know, even infrequently, it amounts to a massive net drag on the economy of the country. And, you know, what you're describing, I felt guilty once or twice when I was traveling because I had my, you know, power outlet going to my battery and the battery going to my phone just because of some cable issues. But it's fascinating hearing like from the boots on the ground of what this physically looks like, managing this problem that is only growing bigger. And Dave, I don't know if you have an IPO, I want to invest in Exergy Energy because it seems like these are boom times.
I'm not plugging anybody or something like that, but like Generac can't keep enough stuff in stock because people are literally buying for their homes, lots and lots of backup generators because they're witnessing this more and more frequently. Now, one of the things that I mentioned before was this sort of price volatility. and I have a couple of issues. And first, we don't play a blame game or get into, you know, that type of thing. Is this is the reality of what's going on out there. You're a business. You need to keep running. Here's how we help you. I don't want to point fingers, et cetera, et cetera. But what happens with the influx of renewables is you get a great, great increase in the volatility of prices. So it used to be, you know, if I had a bunch of coal plants and natural gas plants, the cost to generate is the same all the time. And I just sort of factor up or down based upon load. And load was easy to forecast. Okay. Now the grid is really struggling because load has become more intermittent because we have things like EV chargers, which is just going to get worse. But generation has now become completely variable. So everybody talks about, you know, renewables are the least expensive. And we'll sort of get into that because that is a fallacy. But from the perspective of what it does and their marginal cost, because they don't have any fuel cost or something, they can suppress prices when they're operating and then prices spike at the end. So everybody knows about the duck curve, right? So, you know, prices during the middle of the day could get, you know, almost go negative in a lot of ways. But as soon as the sun comes off, the load is still there. And even worse, the load goes up because people now are going home, turning on their air conditioning. So the prices spike. And the reason the prices spike is now you got to bring in generation immediately, ramp it up. It has to be fast acting, which is your most expensive stuff. So yes, the solar may be inexpensive when the sun's out, but when the sun goes down and you have to recover from that rapid fall off, it's extraordinarily expensive. So in like Texas, there's a program called ECRS that is focused strictly on incentivizing generators. We consider ourselves a generator. If I put backup generators in or something, I'm there to help support the grid. Because when the solar rolls off at 5 or 6 or 7 o'clock and the wind hasn't picked up, the ramp rate is astronomical and prices can go literally from the middle of the day at, I just ran the ERCOT numbers, you know, $15, $20 a megawatt hour to at 9 p.m. go to $5,000 a megawatt hour. All right. You can get your clock cleaned with just a few hours of exposure. Now, this happened to a lot of people when Uri hit is, you know, they were on what's called an index contract. It wasn't a fixed price contract. They were just buying from the grid. And their usual bill was, you know, $100 a month or something like that. They were getting bills in the several thousands during that period of time because, you know, rates spiked. And at that time, ERCOT had a different circuit breaker. Prices in ERCOT could go to $9,000 a megawatt hour. $9,000. So this volatility has now become a factor in how you manage your operations, manage your plant, and things like that. So the thing, again, this is finance, right? Somebody's got to take the risk. So if you're a business and you say, I need predictability, I can't take this risk, you got to pay somebody else to take that risk. So your energy supplier, whether it's a utility, retail energy provider or something, they're the ones that's got to source the energy for you. So your price is going to go up to compensate them for taking the risk. And that premium gets to be really quite significant. So one of the things we do with our customers is if they got mission critical operations and they need backup power, we'll use those backup generators to protect them from those periods of time where prices, you know, fly off the handle, and we can keep them on index. They can buy the lowest cost energy. And then when it goes crazy, turn the generator on and say, you know, it's cheaper for me to self-generate. So it's super interesting out there in the markets these days.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the complexity is mind-blowing. I was in Australia recently, and they're really struggling with a lot of these issues. And the amount of human resources that are going into all of the kind of management services that are a bit beyond me, but which you're helping me kind of get a grasp of, is wild. And again, you talk about Nigeria and just the waste of physical resources, the additional mining and manufacturing that goes into this massive backup system. US is nowhere near being there yet. Australia is nowhere near being there yet, but we're kind of heading in that direction. And in terms of, you know, the copper, the steel, whatever you need, the electromagnets, that's one side of it. But like, we're in a bit of a demographic squeeze in the Western world. And you think of the sheer human talent, like you have a finite number of engineers that you can produce in a society, right? And we've not been producing as many as the Chinese because everyone's, I guess people are learning to code. That's the kind of engineering maybe, but you know what I mean? In terms of this stuff. And also, not to go on too long of a diatribe here, but the grid is shifting. You know, we had this pace of breakneck globalization and moved a lot of manufacturing over where there was cheap labor and less regulation. And that made products cheaper despite real income not really going up in the West. Anyway, we're heading into a play in this new multipolar world. There's reindustrialization. There's, you know, big baseload demand that's coming back. Not to mention the AI data centers, like gigawatt scale data centers, you know, imposing a massive demand on the grid. And it all seems like it's just a very inefficient way to run a power system, to run a society ultimately that depends on that power system. That is a, you know, big commentary, lots to pull on there. Take it away, whatever you want to grab from that.
We don't necessarily be socialists here, but let's take a couple of those. One, data centers are insane. We work with data centers, right? Data centers, you know, you power a small city now with a data, you know, the power for a data center. I don't know if you saw the announcement yesterday. At least I saw it yesterday. Amazon Web Services buying Talon's, you know, nuke plant thing. It's like Microsoft has now signed an agreement. They expect to use small nuclear reactors to power their data centers going forward. AI.
Do they need small or they need, I mean, these are gigawatt scale places. Like, you know, I've heard plans around, we'll build micro reactor in the backyard and, you know, partially power or fully power a data center. But now we're talking gigawatt scale.
When you cluster them together. Yeah. So we've worked with data centers where one center is 180 megawatts. You know, they do a cluster. You could get up to 360, you know, megawatts. You can't find places to connect to the grid anymore. So, you know, for those type of data centers. But stepping back, let's talk it from a standpoint of culture and society. What we are trying to do is take the most complex, largest machine mankind has ever built. That is the grid. And we're trying to essentially reverse engineer it, change it in all kinds of things without a plan, literally without a plan. So we kind of think of it in a naive perspective of capitalism solves all problems. Eventually, yes, but after there's an awful lot of pain. So without a plan, we're just essentially incentivizing and throwing all kinds of stuff, you know, out there to see what sticks. Like, oh, we have these, you know, $1 trillion incentive to put solar, wind, and everything else. Great. You put that out.
And frankly, that's not capitalism. That's not capitalism, these massive subsidies, right? I mean, I can hear the capitalists screaming that in the background. Like, you're not describing a free market system. This is government intervention in the markets, renewables targets. But you're right. There's no plan for the base function of the electric grid, which is fundamentally reliable power.
Yeah, I mean, again, from the developers, and again, not a slight against them, building, you know, large wind, large solar or something like that. How do you get the power? You know, now you need the transmission lines and things like that. They don't exist. So I think the EIA most recent numbers were, we need $1 trillion of investment in the United States just in transmission lines if we're going to play the renewable game, because you can't co-locate a wind farm in the middle of a city. I can put a small nuclear reactor at an old coal plant that sits outside the city, but I'm not going to put, you know, a 600 megawatt wind farm, you know, in Brooklyn or something like that. So again, I'll say, and then again, I don't want to get into the blame game. I'll say it's a lack of leadership. Speaking as an engineer and a previous project manager scares the crap out of me that we're literally doing this without a plan. And it's tough because it is a free market. But again, you go back to capitalism and things like that, you have what's known as hyperbolic discounting. So things that are further out get really, really discounted a lot. So if you're looking for business to do it, business is going to look at a timeline of a couple of years, maybe 5 years or something like that. Because if it doesn't pay for itself in 5 years, forget it. Who's going to do the longer term stuff that's there? And then not only are we throwing in, you know, the renewables and taking away the baseload, you know, the previous baseload stuff at a rate that is not allowing for the load growth in the grid, all right, we're also now pushing increased load. So yes, move to heat pumps. Heat pumps, great, super efficient. EVs, hey, go EVs, great, you know, lower carbon, all those things. But we're pushing more load. At the same time, we're not pushing increased capacity on the grid. And the capacity we are adding is intermittent. So we are literally, and this is why essentially XRG exists, as we forecast this out, we see more and more problems coming, not only in power quality, but outages. Because, you know, weather can change relatively rapidly. The amount of what's called capacity margin on the grid has declined. More importantly, the amount of dispatchable capacity margin has really declined. And the only thing the grid can do then is literally shutter load and brownouts and things like that. Every ISO in the United States over the past year has warned of increased brownouts and outages moving forward, at least for the next decade.
In terms of the vital signs, I mean, there's, you know, in medicine, there's subtle vital signs, such as someone's like mentation, like, are they awake, alert? Can they talk to you? That infers a lot about their circulatory status. That probably means they have a good blood pressure. That's obvious. Then there's stuff where you got to stop and really measure it. And, you know, that gets really complex. It sounds like so far, this power quality issue and outage issue has been cloaked because that's a more subtle vital sign. And you know, right now, these 5-minute blackouts are not becoming so common that they're in the popular consciousness or imagination. You know, industrial manufacturers are not necessarily, you know, communicating that information to the general lay public, who frankly don't even know how the sausage gets made. So it sounds like that's a real issue. And you know, you're someone who's putting the warning signs out there and communicating, hey, there's this subtle stuff going on, but it ain't going to be subtle for long. And you know, you talk about, you know, this capacity margin for reliable generators. I mean, already that's trailing off. And it sounds, I mean, I heard that there's 40 gigawatts of, you know, fossil fuel dispatchable power in PGM that's coming offline in the next 8 years. You're seeing stuff like that in Australia as well. And I mean, in Australia, they're putting the brakes on it. They're keeping these aging coal plants around because they just frankly aren't ready to, you know, accept the damage. So I don't know if you
I mean, you're right in that, in the sense that we're retiring these things, or as more and more intermittent renewables come in, the capacity factor, how much these plants get to run, declines. Because again, it's an open market. So a renewable having basically zero fuel cost or almost zero operating cost is going to bid into the market at extremely low levels. One of the reasons being is they need to generate in order to create the RECs or the PTCs or something like that. So they're going to underbid the gas plants, the coal plants, and everything else while their sun is shining and the wind is blowing, right? So where the capacity factor for a natural gas plant used to be 70 to 80, maybe more percent, the average in the U.S. now has been down in the 40s. Okay, if that's the case, how long can they even stay in business doing that? Because they're not running enough, you know, to essentially create the profit to have the return on capital. So we, again, not a plan, haven't thought it through, is how do we keep the grid stable and, you know, reliable while we're essentially incentivizing all the things to come in that's going to make it less stable and less reliable, right? And now the economics will, or I should say finance and greed, as you're saying, will end up ruling the day. So people will go and say, ooh, you know, this is a real problem. I'm going to keep my peaker plant. We have literally private equity people that are buying peaker plants because the grid needs it for those few hours when, you know, the solar rolls off and the, you know, load's there and things like that. All that's going to do is translate into increased cost, increased prices for everyone.
And you're coasting on these ultra low natural gas prices. And Henry Hub was like $1.50 the other day. And like, presumably at some point, the shale revolution starts slowing down. I mean, some people are already seeing a number of the big fields. I think the Marcellus field is peaked. The Red Queen effect, just having to drill more and more and more to keep up with production needs. I guess Permian's still growing. But like, eventually we hit peak cheap shale. And prices go up. And it seems like that's the whole thing that's sustaining the U.S. economy now. And as this whole grid system gets more and more inefficient, the higher prices are being cloaked by the ultra low cost of natural gas. But eventually, when that price of natural gas goes up, you know, the chickens will come home to roost. You know, not quite Nigerification yet, but heading in that direction towards a really complex Rube Goldberg machine that's inefficient and frankly costs a lot of monetary capital, human capital, and natural resource capital. Like, it's an extraordinary story, and it's not one that's being told enough, and so we're sleepwalking into it.
There's an interesting thing is when you confront somebody, and again, I don't mean to do the blame game here, when you confront somebody with these issues, you know, they always go to the Hail Mary, well, batteries will solve everything. Well, okay, that's fine, but you still got to build the batteries and everything else. The natural gas story has gotten also incredibly complex because historically, oil and gas were not necessarily, they were correlated from an energy perspective and a price perspective, but not correlated in a use perspective. Oil was used for transportation, et cetera, and natural gas was used for, you know, heating and everything else. Shale, tight oil, is the new play now. And so when you say we have super low natural gas prices because we're drilling all the time, why are we drilling? Because we have high oil prices. Natural gas is the unwanted byproduct of oil, right? So as long as oil prices remain high, they're going to keep drilling, which is going to keep the gas literally inexpensive for the United States, which is a boom to, you know, manufacturers, chemical companies, and everybody else who are coming back saying energy's really cheap here. I mean, we see the deindustrialization of Germany because power prices have gotten so high. They're going to come up. They're going to come over here. Now, where will oil go? I mean, people go, oh, well, you know, we're going to go to EVs and therefore we're not going to need that much oil, blah, blah, blah. Passenger cars are only 10% of essentially fossil fuel demand for transportation. So even if you turned all the cars, you know, to EV, you still need diesel for trucks and trains and tankers and airplanes and all of that. Well, are they eventually going to go electrification? Maybe. But how long is it going to take? And then you have the whole issue of, well, what's going to power them? Is it going to be batteries and electricity? Well, I need to mine all of that stuff. So part of the frustration, and I'm going to say part of my paranoia, is, you know, going back to, we're doing this without a plan. We're also doing it without being realistic about how long things take, right? So it's like, well, we're going to just build more batteries. Okay, do we have enough lithium? No. Okay, we need more lithium mines. Well, we don't want lithium mines in my backyard, but it takes 10 years to develop a lithium mine. Well, okay, have we factored that into our calculus of all of these things? In most cases, no, you know, that kind of thing. So what I fear is that things will get worse because we're going to be missing our climate goal targets and our decarbonization and our electrification targets, and we're going to incentivize it even more. And if we incentivize it even more, it's going to make everything else worse. Reliability worse, you know, price volatility will get worse, power quality will get worse, and there will be a revolt, you know, and just say, stop this. You know, we need a plan. I don't know what that outcome might be. You know, going back to your question about capitalism and things like that, do we go back to regulated, you know, utilities and things like that because it's centralized and whatnot? Don't know. All I know is our focus is to help our customers deal with these issues. And you got to stay close to it.
As far as I know, like, America wasn't a communist country in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. So, yeah, it's we've you know, politics have kind of polarized to such a degree in some ways what's up is down, and it's unrecognizable in terms of left and right and capitalism and socialism. But I don't want to tug on that thread too much. Batteries, right? And I know as engineers and scientists, waffly in terms of like not making a clear statement, right? But a lot of people say, listen, and you see this in the media repeated ad nauseum over and over and again, we're not quite there yet, right? You know, wind, solar batteries, not, you know, and maybe even nuclear could be like a bridge technology as we figure out wind, solar batteries. I don't expect to get sort of a yes, no, or it's impossible answer out of you. But I am interested in understanding the use cases of batteries a little bit more. You've described them in terms of your work, in terms of your mission critical clients and power quality and dealing with some of that. But again, in terms of this, I understand there's not certainty out there, but there is probability and there's things that are comically improbable in sort of my read of things. Can batteries paper over the wind solar thing? You've mentioned some of the limits to, you know, mining and minerals. I'm less interested in that. I've had people on to talk about that, but just in terms of their functionality, their scalability, as you move into more and more gigawatt hours of storage, I understand the prices get sort of exponentially worse. So yeah, I mean, respond to that.
There
goddamn
you go.
It.
Okay.
Is that a question, Dr. Kiefer? I don't know, but
there. Okay. So, First off, always remember that finance rules everything. Okay. It's all about, you know, what are my, you know, my rates of return, my IRR and everything. Finance rules everything. So let's go to batteries. Batteries and renewables are capital intensive, operating cost minimal. Fossil fuels are fuel or operating cost intensive, capital unintensive, right? In essence, that changes the dynamics tremendously. So a battery, for it to pay for itself, has to be used frequently, all right? And we've done calculations on it. And if, again, a plug for us, if you go to our website, go to our blog, we have done calculations on batteries, LCOE, and things like that. But let's take it, you know, I need to be charging and discharging at a profit for a lithium ion battery very frequently for it to make sense. Okay. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense. So from the perspective that we were talking about is, oh, the solar rolls off, you know, before the wind comes in, I've got a few hours in there. Great for batteries. Absolutely great for batteries. Now, that being said, there's a limit to how much price arbitrage you can do and still maintain the rate of return you need on that battery, because that's primarily a merchant, it's called a merchant play. A merchant play is not guaranteed, and therefore the risk premium is very, very high. So people are saying, oh, we're going to go into batteries because we can buy power really, really cheap and sell it when it's really expensive. Yes. But that only goes on for a certain amount of time. And then that price arbitrage, that price difference will decrease until the point where you can't make the returns you need on the battery anymore, given the, you know, the risk premium, market premium. But here's the bigger challenge. What do I do with this generation that not only is variable on a day-to-day basis, intermittent, but seasonally, over the year, dramatically different? So solar production in the United States, and this is on an average, solar production in the United States will decline by 60% in the winter compared to the summer. Okay, so now what do we do? Well, batteries. Well, wait a second. If I'm going to store energy from the summer, and I'm going to use it 6 months later, that means I get one round trip use of that battery, one round trip, and it's all capital, right? So I'm going to turn it once. So I'm storing energy in the summer, let's say, and again, I'm making numbers up here. It's $20 a megawatt hour. I've got literally, you know, millions of dollars in battery tied up that I'm going to use once that year. So I buy it at 20, I hold it for 6 months. What do I have to sell it at in order to justify that investment? It's enormous. We've done the calculations of, given different battery types, what is the minimum number of charge discharge cycles at a profit that you can do. So to sort of add insult to injury a little bit, so they talk about, oh, we're talking about long duration storage. Long duration storage, by definition, this is from the National Renewable Energy Laboratory. Long duration storage is, you want to take a guess? 100 hours. That's long duration. Okay. So look at lithium ion as 2 to 4 to 8 hours. Now, long duration flow batteries, the iron air batteries, et cetera. Long duration, 100 hours, right? We have 8,760 hours in a year. So 6 months wait time is 4,500 hours, right? We have nothing to compensate for that. So then what do you do? Again, because it's all capital. So do I build, and what's originally was not that big a problem because your load was so much higher in the summer because of air conditioning than it was in the winter because winter was natural gas heating. Now we electrify everything. Now we add EVs. Now what we're doing is flattening the load curve. So the load in wintertime and in some locations in the United States, load in January and February is now higher than it is in the summertime. Okay, but solar output's going to be the same. Doesn't make any difference. So what am I supposed to do? So do I look at the load in wintertime and build sufficient solar capacity to be able to handle the wintertime? And now I've got, I'll call it 1.x times more than I need in the summertime. What am I going to do with that energy? Right? Because I don't have long duration storage. So again, people haven't thought this stuff through. There isn't a plan, and it's like, now, so what are the plans? Plans are, we need just more transmission, right? So if we have, big transmission line, we can solve sort of that day to day. Well, I don't know, from an annual perspective. So it's looking at, maybe what we need to do is, the Sahara, or we're going
to. David, we need to hibernate in the winter. That's what we need to do.
There you go. There you go.
And just demand response, baby. Just take a long nap, turn off all the lights, and get some warm blankets out. I don't know. It gets a bit ridiculous. I was started throwing around this term, actually. I think I got it from Al Scott. I want to give credit where credit's due, and I thought it was brilliant. Doctrine of Parallel Discovery, I'm sure a bunch of people have thought about it. But this term, energy Lysenkoism. Trofim Lysenko, famous geneticist, infamous geneticist out of the Soviet Union, who rejected Darwinian evolution because it didn't really fit in with communist ideology, and said, if we want to grow hardy wheat in the north, we got to, put those seeds in cold water for a while, and they're going to sort of carry that memory as we plant them. And this led to big, big famines in the Soviet Union, right? And it infiltrated Chinese science or communist science. Again, just because it was ideologically convenient, and they didn't like this idea that, hey, there's competition and, there's pressures and certain organisms succeed. That sounds a lot like capitalism. It seems like, you say people haven't thought this through, but at the same time, I agree with you, but people are pretty firm in their convictions about the direction they're taking. And it seems ideological, not based in, engineering reality. But can you comment a little bit on the sort of sociocultural factors? Because I mean, again, I don't want to play the blame game. Well, I kind of do. There's people at the DOE that are pushing this hard. And I understand if you got to be diplomatic, and I won't name names, but it's wild. And it is, to me, it's energy Lysenkoism.
Well, you mentioned, again, decouple's one of my favorites, okay? Another favorite who you just mentioned early on was Doomberg. Again, another one of my favorite. He has a wonderful saying, which was politics by platitude. And it's exactly that. Is everybody goes, yes, I want renewable, I want zero carbon, I want all this thing, I want to combat climate change. What are you willing to give up? Nothing, right? And the path that we are on is the path toward reduction in the standard of living. I think I go back like Nate Hagen's The Great Simplification. What are we simplifying? We're simplifying our lives in order to use less energy. Well, in using less energy, you have a lower standard of living, right?
And that could mean people fly private jets less, but just understanding how society works, it's the poor that get hit by that harder than anybody. The rich can afford to continue to use copious amounts of energy. It's a bigger, marginal increase, in their cost of living. They can budget for it.
It's irrelevant.
This energy poverty thing, it's a massive tax on the poor. And that's what kind of drives me nuts about it, and sort of the degrowthers and whatnot. you know, the Hagans, the Art Bermans out there. You know, I think I respect a lot of their analysis, and I find them intriguing and interesting. I'll talk to them because again, I think they've got fascinating things to say, but there's a huge naivete about, yeah, this quality of living. And you can go, oh, we're all rich here in the West and we can definitely tighten our belts. But it's like, who tightens their belt?
Well, no.
Who goes into energy poverty?
Who are you going to ask to tighten their belts? I mean, if you look at the, there was a recent report, it's on our website if you want to get it, from Ernst & Young, who did their annual sort of decarbonization analysis. You know, what's the support in the country? 70% of people say, yes, we want to do more, but no, we won't spend any more. Okay, so as long as it's free, it's good. But if I have any, if I have to give up something, pay something or something, I'm not going to do it. So we do not have, from, I'd say, an educated populace, we do not have an educated populace that really understands the implications of what we're doing. Now, you sort of mentioned, like, we obviously, we're a small company, we raise money and everything else. We have challenges raising money because we don't pass the purity test. Okay? So when we talk to investors and things like that, they go, oh, we just love your model and everything else, but, like, you got a natural gas generator. No, we can't do that. Can't you do it all with solar and batteries? No, you can't. you just can't do it. So I am concerned that without a more stringent guiding plan and light, we're going to allow the, and I don't mean this in a negative, but the laissez-faire process is not necessarily going to get us where we want to. Capitalism does not, like evolution, capitalism does not guarantee success every minute of the day. It guarantees on the long run, you will probably get the most efficient, or going to evolution, you'll get the fittest for the conditions that exist at that time. Capitalism will do that by allocating resources, but the price signals are not, you know, whether I reproduce or not, it's what my returns are. So right now, because of tax incentives and everything else, the returns are heavily dominated in putting more intermittent renewables on, and nowhere is it to maintaining sort of, the fossil fuel based power situation. So again, we look at it as the trajectory is going to be more problematic going forward, unfortunately.
So we've talked about, again, I'm going to air quote it, energy transition. Certainly, you know, we have added renewable capacity, as a share percentage wise, there's decreased fossil fuels, but in absolute terms, more fossil fuels than ever. Great report out. Got JP Morgan, Eye on the Market, Electrovision. I think Michael Sembalast was the main author. This just came across my radar. I think it's published March 5th, so it's pretty recent. They talk about, okay, this energy transition it's based upon electrification of a whole bunch of stuff. We're not making progress there. We've electrified very little in terms of, you know, these other end uses, which are not currently electrified. We've added a bunch of renewable capacity. You're throwing in this comment that, you know, that has actually created massive problems on the grid and made the whole system less reliable and less friendly to further electrification. Because it's too risk. It's, you know, we're getting into stuff that's really high reliability, like keeping your home warm and freezing cold temperatures, or, you know, other industrial processes. You know, you add to that, and I can't ignore this again, just the pace at which AI is taking off. You've got Sam Altman saying we need an energy revolution for this whole thing to pan out. I'm not sure I want it to pan out, frankly, because I kind of like, keeping the cognitive tools sharp amongst humanity, and I'm a little bit worried about that. Sometimes it makes me want to become a renewable energy advocate, frankly, because when the AI is about to take over, hopefully some clouds run over and give us a little chance to shrug that off. But talk a little bit about this combination of crises: our failure to actually electrify all that much, the addition of unstable power, and now we're trying to electrify things on for climate reasons, but the biggest kind of, I think, demand that's coming onto the grid now, and you mentioned that Amazon deal with
Talon.
I forget Talon and Susquehanna nuclear plant. I mean, it's, you know, a lot of nuclear fans are saying, hey, this is great. It's going to get a lot of nuclear built. Maybe that's a good thing. But right now they're using existing nuclear and they're taking that energy away from, you know, other potential decarbonization or just other, you know, low carbon electricity is being used on AI. I'm not sure if most of it's like the internet going to be put into just making really high quality porn or what exactly. But I'm ranting here, but in terms of AI, what do you see as the future there? Are they mission critical in terms of power disruptions?
Oh, wow.
What's the impact going to be on the grid? I've just asked you like 20 questions at once. I'm horrible at this.
Focus it down here. All right.
Oh my God. I know.
Since we like to quote people, so Euripides once said, man is blind until he's given a metaphor that permits him to see.
Damn,
so the metaphors that are in people's mind, and we can talk of like in nuclear, the anti-nuclear advocates have done a really, really good job of creating the narrative, right? The renewable energy, the decarbonization, the climate thing has done a really, really good job of essentially controlling that narrative. And that is, in fact, you know, problematic because we have that view that technology is going to save us and everything, right? So another sort of, so related to that metaphor, people have this feeling that the energy system is like the internet, all right? That it's like computer power, all right? So like, ooh, the distributed generation is like the internet, right? And the internet is governed by what's called Metcalfe's law, which is the value of the network increases by the square of the number of interconnected nodes. That's Metcalfe's law. But that is about information flow. I can duplicate information as many times as I want with no loss of fidelity. So you send me something, I go, oh, that's cool. I can send it on, right? So a physical network, and power or energy is a physical network. If I'm connected and I consume, that's it. I can't move that stuff to you once I've consumed it. So a network, which is physical in this respect, goes by a different scaling factor. So the complexity of a physical network, which is what we call an energy and mass conserved network, the complexity increases by n factorial, which is more than the square of Metcalfe's law, which means the more things we interconnect, the complexity increases very dramatically, very, very dramatically. Now, what does everybody want to do? We have two aspects of AI here. Everybody wants to have AI doing their thing. So I'm going to sell you I'm going to sell you a battery, or I'm going to sell you a generator, and I have AI that's going to run it and it's going to watch the market prices and everything else. What happens when I have tens of thousands of independent AIs looking at the data and learning from each other? Right? It's like the Terminator thing here, right? Is one AI going to play games because another AI is going to react to that and will be able... So
wow.
Before AI, we would have these situations in automation. It's called a race condition, where different control systems are trying to control kind of the same thing, or they're related somehow, and they literally, you know, bounce back and forth between each other, and it never settles down. So I am very concerned about the proliferation of AI independently. An AI running the whole grid? Cool. 1,000 or 10,000 AIs running distributed energy all over the place and things like that? Going to be a real issue, my opinion. Going to be a real issue. And then we go to the next thing, which is just to power those AIs that we're all going to use. I think they're forecasting that with the growth of AI, data centers could represent 40% of the energy consumption in the next 10 years in the United States. Okay, but think about it. Everything we do is based on data, is kind of based on data centers today. So when you mention electrification, we've seen a lot of success in electrification at the residential level. heat pumps, EVs, and things like that. Those are relatively easy. Still putting a strain on the grid, no doubt about that, especially EVs. EVs are really problematic. We're working with some EV charging situations right now ourselves. They can also cause a tremendous amount of noise and power quality issues and things like that. But the other aspects, 25% of energy total. Now, this is electricity, heat, everything else. 25% of energy consumed is in the form of industrial heat. So very hard to electrify that stuff. And if you do, you don't have the infrastructure to support it. So we have people come to us with a manufacturing plant and say, "Ooh, we want to electrify our boilers, et cetera, et cetera." We go, "Okay, fine. Let's take a look at that." "Oh, okay. We're just going to increase your load by a factor of 10. Okay, so now we have to get a new substation in there. The utility can't handle it. We have to run wires." Again, people haven't thought this through, in my opinion. There isn't a plan. And we, blame game here. I go back to 1985, Carl Sagan addressed joint session of Congress and said in 1985, the biggest problem facing mankind is climate change. We are now, 40 years on, we haven't really done squat, right? And now we've got the compounding problem, and the compounding problem is we haven't addressed climate change. Now we're rushing to try and do it, but we've already, as Doomberg likes to say, we're already living the climate change experiment. And what we're doing is the climate is making the grid and everything else less reliable, because 78% of outages are due to weather, bringing wires down, bringing trees down and everything else. So we've created a process which makes the grid's reliability lower at the same time as we're sort of systemically making the grid's reliability lower by intermittent and renewables and things like that. So again, we've got compounding problems there, which is, again, why we exist to help our customers.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's like partially your fault that I'm asking or making these sweeping commentaries, because you say so many goddamn interesting things and I want to like address a whole bunch of them. I don't want to interrupt you because you're an amazing flow. I'm gonna kind of comment on like three things and then we've got to wrap up. But I have a feeling, if you're willing, David, you're going to be a frequent flyer here on Decouple. A couple things. I mean, we've talked before about Amory Lovins and the soft path. The hard path, what they did in Quebec with hydroelectricity, overbuilding these massive dam systems, what we did in Ontario with a massive nuclear fleet we put together. This is the kind of electrification, I wish Carl Sagan had tapped into energy and been able to praise that and say, this is the solution. We need hard power, low carbon hard power. Because then we'd have the surplus electricity to actually be able to start some of this industrial decarbonization with reliable sources that match the demand. Anyway, that's number one. I'm not even necessarily going to get to respond to that.
I'm going to respond to that one.
Okay.
If I can. Okay. Because you mentioned hydropower in Canada. Love it. Going back to fight climate change. We want a decarbonized economy, blah, 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 blah. But we're not willing to pay for it. We're not willing to take any pain whatsoever. So a great example is Massachusetts is literally shutting off. I don't mean shutting off natural gas. They're not expanding the pipelines at all. They're shifting people away from it, et cetera, et cetera. Now they don't have enough Now they don't have enough electricity. So they said, "Oh, let's build a transmission line from Hydro Canada down to Massachusetts." Couldn't get it done because Vermont wouldn't agree to it. New Hampshire wouldn't agree to it. Maine wouldn't agree to it and things like that. So now it's like, okay, unless we all work together, we're not getting anywhere on this thing, right?
And Quebec lost $1 billion of export money on their electricity because, there was, why was New York choked in smoke? Well, because of wildfires. Why were the wildfires so bad? Because there's no goddamn rain in northern Quebec. Their reservoirs are really low. They actually, again, in terms of electrification and the hard path, they heat mostly with electricity in Quebec. And so they have to hold back water in those reservoirs so they don't freeze to death in the winter. We've had a mild winter, but you got to plan for the worst. So they had less summer exports, which is unheard of. So even if you built those wires, hydro is also, you know, affected by not intermittency on a, again, a daily basis, but on a seasonal basis. And so that's a big deal. Just, I wanted to tug on a few more threads from what you said before. I think when people think about, you know, AI and this kind of like potential AI takeover and AGI just replacing humans, often we think of it as a monolith. And so what you're describing here in terms of like competing AIs reminds me a lot of like game theory, like Cold War yes. game theory, and the way that they could, you know, learn from each other, play off each other, you know. And I don't know where the human element and human values and the so-called alignment that, you know, people are trying to work into AI, it seems like that falls off the ramp pretty quickly. But that is absolutely terrifying as a concept. I could let you riff on that. Then we're really going to have to go in the next few minutes. But, you know,
yeah, you have a day
give
job.
Give you the opportunity job, to respond.
Got
to
save lives. Okay.
It's true. With reliable electricity.
That's God, right. Well, it's good that you're where you are. You got reliable electricity.
For now. Yes, sir. Okay, listen, as I said, David, I am so grateful for this. My fiance thinks I'm very vain because quite often she hears me listening to my own voice. I tell her it's like an athlete. You got to get tape on yourself. You got to kind of analyze how you're doing, both as a guest and as a host. But I have a feeling I'm going to be re-listening to this podcast quite a few times just to get my head around all the we call it medicine, the pearls that you've dropped for us to pick up and reflect on. Your perspectives are incredibly valued here, sir. Thank you for coming on.
Really appreciate it. And again, thank you for all the work that you're doing. Let's look at this as an altruistic type of thing. We're not trying to promote anything. We're trying to educate people as to what is going on, what is likely to happen, and provide them with information to help them to plan and be able to, as we say, you know, manage and prosper as much as possible. But the changes are coming and, you know, we got to deal with them. As Doomberg said, we're running the experiment. It's too late now. So, Chris, thank you so much. Okay. Appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.